Do you ever wonder where all your money went? Like every single time you look at your bank account? Honestly, it's probably all those subscriptions. I felt that way too, until I got Rocket Money. Rocket Money helped me see all the subscriptions I'm paying for, and it was eye-opening. Between streaming services, fitness apps, delivery services, it all adds up so quickly. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year, with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
This spring, if you'd rather spend time enjoying your lawn instead of trying to keep it alive, there's good news. TruGreen is the easiest and most affordable way to get a beautiful lawn. All you have to do is water and mow, and they'll do the rest. Weed control, fertilization, aeration, and even some things you might not even think of. They'll do all of it, while you can do literally anything else. With True Green, you could have your lawn looking as good as a putting green. That's not hyperbole. True Green is the official lawn care treatment provider of the PGA Tour. True Green offers a satisfaction guarantee, and they have a verified best price promise, which guarantees you the lowest price with no compromise on quality. You do you. Let True Green do your lawn care. Visit TrueGreen.com to get the best lawn at the best price with the best people guaranteed.
The viewpoints expressed by the host are her own and do not necessarily reflect the views of CBS News Radio.
Welcome to the Martin Luther King Jr. Day holiday special presented by CBS News Radio. I'm Nina Turner. The foundation upon which the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s enduring legacy was built was King's guiding principle of nonviolence.
Now, what I'm saying is this. I would like for all of us to believe in nonviolence, but I'm here to say tonight that if every Negro in the United States turns against nonviolence, I'm going to stand up as a lone voice and say this is the wrong way.
I will never change in my basic idea that nonviolence is the most potent weapon available to the Negro in his struggle for freedom and justice.
One of the most prominent victims of gun violence himself, Martin Luther King was assassinated on April the 4th, 1968. The threat of gun violence was not a theoretical construct for King. He and his family faced numerous death threats, and to this day, the scourge of gun violence plagues our country while disproportionately affecting Black Americans. African Americans experience 10 times the gun homicides, 18 times the gun assault injuries, and nearly 3 times the fatal shootings by police compared to white Americans, according to the organization Every Town for Gun Safety. Here to talk with us about Reverend King and gun violence is Cornell William Brooks, the former president and CEO of the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, a civil rights attorney, and an ordained minister, as well as a professor at Harvard University. Cornell William Brooks, thank you for joining us.
I'm delighted to be with you to talk about Dr. King and his words and work and his life and his legacy. And certainly honored to be with you, given that you represent so many of the causes and concerns of his life that inspired his life, that animated his life. So delighted to be with you.
We're so glad to have you too, Professor Brooks. So given Dr. King's adherence to the practice of nonviolent protest and his opposition to the Vietnam War, many people might be surprised to learn that Dr. King at one point of his life was a gun owner, specifically as a means to protect himself and his family. In fact, one civil rights leader said King's home was, quote, an arsenal. What was Dr. King's rationale for owning a gun?
Sure. So if you can imagine, in the late 1950s, following the Montgomery boycott, Dr. King's life was inundated His phone lines were inundated with death threats. And so he would pick up the phone, or Coretta Scott King would pick up the phone, and there would be those who would literally besiege their ears with the N-word and obscenities. And he not only knew that his life was under threat, but his home had been bombed. And in the wake of the bombing of his home, he secured firearms to protect himself. And Dr. King experienced the fear that many Americans experience in terms of fearing violence. And his response to the fear of violence was to secure a firearm. And this is not unlike what many Americans grapple with today. But what's important here is not merely that he owned a gun, but he decided to give up his guns in service of nonviolence. And his belief that he was safer embracing the philosophy of nonviolence than he was with owning a gun. As he put it, no gun can protect me, no handgun can protect me from a bomb.
And so, and that is very true. And, you know, even in our community, as we grapple with the very real realities of some of our sisters and brothers and family and friends in this nation believing so strongly that the Second Amendment to the Constitution is an absolute, you know, they feel that deeply in their bones. And the fact that you can own a gun and be very much against gun violence, you know, as you're describing, Professor Brooks, Dr. King's rationale to get it was for protection. It wasn't to be out there rampantly, you know, waving a gun or believing that the Second Amendment was absolute like so many others in this country that I frankly disagree with. But there is that duality, especially in the Black community of many in our community, believing that they should have a gun, which is their constitutional right, who are not, you know, they are against gun violence themselves. I mean, I think I'm thinking about Ida B. Wells right now. I'm not sure if you're picking up that same vibe, but, you know, in the face of white supremacy, I mean, like brute white supremacy in your face on a regular basis for her and her contemporaries. I mean, two of her friends got killed because they were successful, and the whites in that community resented that so much that they resorted to violence, which is the story of many of our, not just our ancestors, but some of our elders that are walking the face of this earth right now. But Ida B. Wells herself said, you know, basically a best friend, you know, paraphrasing her, but a Smith and Wesson is something that every Black person should have.
That's right. You know, Ida B. Wells, is as you lifted up, historically speaking, was the subject of death threats, the subject of lynching threats. She witnessed, if not in person, but certainly at an emotionally intimate distance, her friends being killed, the city of Memphis being depopulated as a consequence of racialized violence, lynchings. And as a consequence, she believed in guns as a means of community preservation and self-protection. So there is within the Black community, and certainly even within the philosophy of Dr. King, a moral nuance, a moral complexity, such that there's a recognition that there are people who own guns to protect themselves, even as they oppose gun violence and as they embrace nonviolence. And so there are those who have studied the civil rights movement who note the fact that there were many protesters and demonstrators, adherents of nonviolence, who were unarmed during the protests, who went home to homes in which there were guns to protect themselves. So that's part of the history. But that being said, it's important, I think, to appreciate the fact that Dr. King gave up his guns in order to serve as a moral exemplar, in order to lift up the eloquence of his own example, in terms of serving as a role model for the movement. So part of the reason he gave up his guns was because he literally believed that for him to own a gun and to lead a nonviolent movement would undercut the viability of the movement. So I think it's really, really important here to appreciate his moral discipline, his philosophical discipline, and also his sacrifice, because ultimately he gave up his guns and believed he was safer without them than with them. but yet he died at the hands of gun violence.
Yeah. Oh my God. I mean, this is, it's really hard to, for one, to wrap their minds around, you know, exactly what you're saying right now, because it's so deep and so profound and so troubling at the same time, because you have a man giving it all. I mean, he's putting it all on the line, him and Mrs. Coretta Scott King, the entire family, and making these extraordinary sacrifices that very few people would be willing to make. And at the same time, he was assassinated. He was killed by gun. And, you know, at that time, it was very difficult for a Black person to legally own a gun in some jurisdictions. I don't think many of us understand or appreciate that. In fact, Dr. King was denied a concealed carry permit in Alabama.
That's right. That's right. And as you recall, you know, all too well, the police at that time had the discretion to designate a person unsuitable, unfit to have a concealed weapon permit. Alabama denying him a concealed weapon permit because of his race, and nevertheless subjecting him as a citizen of Alabama to the threats and the real possibility, probability of being a victim of racialized violence.
We'll have more of the Martin Luther King Jr. Day holiday special presented by CBS News Radio with Cornell William Brooks right after this. Welcome back to the Martin Luther King Jr. Day holiday special presented by CBS News Radio. I'm Nina Turner. We will continue now with Cornell William Brooks, the former president and CEO of the NAACP, and our conversation about Martin Luther King and gun violence.
You know, he died at the hands of gun violence, started his civil rights career endeavoring to protect himself and protect his family. And yet we have people today who try to twist and contort his legacy by, you know, making him out to be a de facto supporter of the NRA and their present understanding of gun violence. And so there's just so much here to unpack, right? You know, like think about the fact that it was Dr. King's death that literally gave birth to the modern NRA. Meaning, he was killed. Congress passes the Gun Control Act of 1968 in response to Dr. King's death, in response to Robert Kennedy's death, in response to John F. Kennedy's death. And because Congress responded to this gun violence with this major piece of gun reform legislation, the NRA literally ramps up its opposition to any form of gun control and literally comes into being as this gun phallic, this gun worshiping, gun fetishizing organization that we know today. So many ironies here.
Very much. I mean, multifaceted ironies going on, swirling around. And I think Dr. King would certainly be disgusted by what the NRA is today. And, you know, so many of the deaths of children and just innocent people, whether they're children or not, but especially our children, and the fact that we lack the moral courage as a nation. And when I say we, I'm really referring to elected officials to really bump up against the NRA in a stronger way, because so many of our elected officials, unfortunately, are co-opted by their owner donors. But this is indeed fascinating. And you had already mentioned the fact that Dr. King decided that it would be better to not have a gun, you know, even in the onslaught of the death threats, you know, he renounced gun ownership. And as you laid out, he rid himself in his home of the deadly weapons. And Dr. King said these words, which you already alluded to, and I'm quoting him here: "I was much more afraid in Montgomery when I had a gun in my house, when I decided that I couldn't keep a gun. I came face to face with the question of death, and I dealt with it. From that point on, I no longer needed a gun, nor have I been afraid," end quote. And you laid out, Professor Brooks, what caused this change for Dr. King, but what such selfless words to say. And it really took a deep-seated awakening for Dr. King to utter those words and then to mirror those words by his very actions and deeds.
That's right. And I would say that the words that you lifted up in terms of Dr. King's opposition to gun ownership and his opposition to the fear of death, those words were echoed on the night before he died in Memphis, when he gave his famous mountaintop speech, in which he said, I'm not fearing any man, and that he was unafraid. And so the point being here is there's a moral consistency to Dr. King that I think is really, really important and really inspiring. And here's what I mean. Dr. King did not walk into America's moral conscience fully formed, fully created. He evolved, he changed, he learned. When he began the Montgomery boycott, or began his leadership of the Montgomery boycott, he was not a particularly sophisticated or well-studied student of nonviolence. He had written about Thoreau in college. He knew of Gandhi, but he was not a long-studied or well-studied student of Gandhi at the beginning of the Montgomery boycott. It's only when Bayard Rustin entered his life, if you will, as a kind of nonviolent tutor, that he steeped himself in the philosophy of nonviolence. And so what this says to us on this anniversary of his birth is that we as moral beings can learn, can grow, we can study, we can evolve, we can change for the better. And so for those who are grappling with how do we come to grips with the gun violence which has seized our country, I would simply encourage people to not merely celebrate Dr. King, but emulate Dr. King. Study his words. Ponder the meaning of his life. Read the people he read. And in so doing, you literally imbibe and ingest and bring into your own being the substance of his philosophy and the power of his life.
And what you are challenging all of us to do, Dr. Brooks, is it requires some sacrifice. It requires some self-awareness. It requires not just looking at Dr. King as this kind of stale symbol of what was.
That's right.
He really is very much what is and what can be. I mean, the philosophies that he lived his life, by which he lived his life, is not just about the past. It is very much about the present. And it is about the future. So you are challenging us in a way that certainly I believe, and I'm sure so many others that are joining us in this conversation believe as well. There were, you know, more gun deaths in America in 2020 than in any other year, almost 50,000 people. And the gun culture in America is unlike that of any other country in the world. And I have seen essays contrasting the Second Amendment with the Second Commandment. I mean, if you can really, I mean, that's how deep this goes. And the Second Commandment says, I am the Lord your God, and you shall have no false gods before me. But in America, the idolatry of guns seems to fly in the face of the Second Commandment. What do you make of that? Because so many, especially, you know, of the people who are holding up the Second Amendment as absolute, probably many of them, and there's, you know, we got anecdotal, but there's empirical data out there too, probably liken themselves to Christians and probably uphold the Ten Commandments. You know, they would have gun in one hand, the Bible in the other. That contradiction between how they worship the Second Amendment, but then would not place the Second Commandment in that same. They can't. You can't have two. You can't, I believe, both of those things at the same time. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, let me start with why I think the way I think. My perspective is informed by the fact that I was raised in the bosom of the Black Church, Bethel AME Church in Georgetown, South Carolina. I studied Dr. King's philosophy at Boston University School of Theology, his alma mater. I'm a fourth generation minister in the AME Church, and I'm a civil rights lawyer having studied at Yale Law School. So I take up the question both theologically and legally. And so theologically speaking, in the Christian tradition, Christian theology traditionally holds that nothing can be venerated, worshiped, lifted up, committed to more than God. God comes first. And that was certainly true in Dr. King's philosophy. God first, God's children thereafter. Legally speaking, this notion that the Second Amendment is more important than any of the other amendments, and that the Second Amendment invests the individual with an unfettered right to own any gun under any circumstances with any kind of ammunition, irrespective of its lethality, is ahistorical. It is incorrect. It is a contradiction of the understanding of the majority of scholars when it comes to the Second Amendment. So in other words, the Second Amendment doesn't invest, many people believe, the Second Amendment doesn't invest the individual with the right, but it recognizes the right of state militias, okay? So the point being here is that gun ownership is not a theological right, and it is not an unfettered legal right, and it does not subvert the whole of the Constitution. And so when we look at the life of Dr. King, certainly there's nothing in his life that would suggest theologizing the legal right to own a gun. And there's nothing in American constitutional history or scholarship that would lend support for this common understanding of gun ownership, namely that you can have as many guns as you want with whatever firepower you deem necessary, that you can carry them in any place in society and use them at will. There's quite simply nothing to support that.
We'll have more of the Martin Luther King Jr. Day holiday special presented by CBS News Radio with Cornell William Brooks right after this. Welcome back to the Martin Luther King Jr. Day holiday special presented by CBS News Radio. I'm Nina Turner. We will continue now with Cornell William Brooks, the former president and CEO of the NAACP, and our conversation about Martin Luther King and gun violence.
You know, after Dr. King's death, there were lots of riots and looting in some of the major metropolitan areas in our country. And gun advocates definitely used this as an argument for white people needing to arm themselves. You know, this fear of those people for protection from, and those people being Black people. What is the relationship between gun ownership and systemic racism in America?
Thank you. Thank you so much for asking what is a hard question, but is a question that can't be done. So let's look at the history. So the most popular, most lethal, most infamous instrument of mass murder in this country, the AR-15, in military terms, the M-16. It came into being right about the same time as this modern civil rights movement came into being in the 1950s. When Dr. King was assassinated at the hands of white supremacy and gun violence, thereafter, the Gun Control Act of 1968 came into being. And as a consequence of that, the NRA, which had traditionally focused on shooting competitions and gun safety, literally ramps up and becomes this gun fetishizing entity in the body politic, focused on literally this unrestricted, unconstrained exercise of the Second Amendment. And so literally the struggle for civil rights, the struggle for racial justice, was weaponized to fuel gun ownership. So in other words, there's a relationship between white supremacy and gun ownership. So in other words, when we have police departments
who have in their shooting ranges, their practice targets being black faces. And we can even go back to the days of slavery. Why? Because the slaves, the enslaved people were forbidden, prohibited from owning, having, or using guns. In the wake of every slave insurrection, there was a tightening, if you will, on the reins on the black community, including their access to weapons. Subsequent to the abolishment of slavery, the restrictions imposed on the black community were always about literally limiting access to guns. With the ascent of the Black Panther Party, the Black Power movement in this country, those liberatory movements, those expressions of community agency were literally weaponized. And so in order for us to have a rational, thoughtful, moral discussion of gun violence, we have to appreciate its ugly, long racial history in terms of white supremacy.
You know, I mentioned earlier that Black people in America are 10 times more likely to be killed by someone with a gun compared to their white counterparts. What are the ways we can reduce gun violence for all Americans, and specifically those people who are the most adversely affected by it?
Well, one of the things that we can do is to quite simply appreciate the fact that the America of 2023 has not always existed. So one of the things that we can do is literally decrease the sheer number of guns. We just have far too many, far too many. Dr. King was not the only member of the King family to be slain by gun violence. His mother, years after his death in 1974, while playing the organ at Ebenezer Baptist Church, where the Reverend Senator Raphael Warnock now serves as pastor, while she was playing the organ, a young man entered that sacred space, took out two handguns, killed her and a deacon of that church. See, the ubiquity of gun violence is real, right? So as we celebrate Dr. King's, you know, life and legacy, his words and work in terms of nonviolence, we have to appreciate the cost of violence to the King family, not merely in terms of Dr. King being assassinated, but his mother being assassinated.
And Dr. Brooks, thank you so much. You have definitely, we are in class today with you, with Dr. Cornell Brooks. We are the former president and CEO of the NAACP, Harvard professor, and an MLK scholar. We are blessed to be able to have you walk us down memory lane and also tell us the things that we must do individually and collectively to do away with the scourge of gun violence in the United States of America, and also the moral work that must be wedded to legal outcomes in these United States of America. We really do appreciate you.
No, thank you all.
You are listening to the Martin Luther King Jr. Day Holiday Special presented by CBS News Radio. Welcome back to the Martin Luther King Jr. Day Holiday Special presented by CBS News Radio. I'm Nina Turner. Martin Luther King Jr. famously said, "So long as I do not firmly and irrevocably possess the right to vote, I do not possess myself. I cannot make up my mind. It is made up for me. I cannot live as a democratic citizen observing the laws I have helped to enact. I can only submit to the edict of others," end quote. The Voting Rights Act of 1965, along with the 1964 Civil Rights Act and Fair Housing Act, were the three crown jewels of Martin Luther King Jr.'s legacy. But in 2013, the Supreme Court issued a ruling in Shelby County v. Holder, removed a key provision of the Voting Rights Act that many view as an assault on Dr. King's legacy and the constitutional rights of all citizens to participate in our democracy. Joining us now to discuss the state of voting rights in the United States is Nicole Killian,
congressional correspondent for CBS News. Nicole, thanks for being here.
Good to be with you.
And you as well. Let's go back to 1965. Why was the Voting Rights Bill enacted, and what did Section 5, the section that the Supreme Court struck down, provide to help with enforcing voting rights?
Well, I think you have to look at the historic nature of how the Voting Rights Act came together and just the compromise that was forged on all sides to get it over the finish line at a time of great turmoil in our country, at the height of the civil rights movement, on the heels of the Civil Rights Act being passed. You know, I had a chance about a year or so ago to interview the daughter of Lyndon Baines Johnson, who was there when the Voting Rights Act was signed back in 1965. And one thing she talks about is just the bipartisan nature of it and really what it took to win agreement from all sides to enact such historic legislation. And so you counter that with what is happening today, where in the last Congress, we saw Democrats make a number of attempts to try to get voting rights legislation passed to strengthen the law after it had been gutted in part by that Shelby versus Holder decision in 2013, and continue to run into opposition by Republicans time and again. And so now we find ourselves, of course, with a Republican House and a Democratic Senate, both of which are evenly divided, which makes the prospects, I think, of trying to pass future legislation a challenge, but it certainly remains a priority, particularly among Democrats, to try to keep the issue front and center, especially as we saw a lot of new voting laws passed in the wake of the 2020 election and play out during the 2022 midterms.
Yeah, no doubt about that. And we have certainly had times in our country's history, as you were pointing out, what happened in the 60s, of having both Republicans and Democrats with some arm twisting, no doubt, some dealing behind closed doors. I mean, President LBJ was very good at that, at trying to advance voting rights and also civil rights in this country. And the Voting Rights Act needed to be extended on several occasions, and both Republicans and Democratic presidents providing those extensions, including President Ronald Reagan. And he said the following, quote, "Citizens must have complete confidence in the sanctity of their right to vote." And that's what this legislation is all about. It provides confidence that constitutional guarantees are being upheld and that no vote counts more than another. To so many of our people, our Americans of Mexican descent, our Black Americans, this measure is as important symbolically as it is practically. It says to every individual, your vote is equal, your vote is meaningful, your vote is your constitutional right, end quote. But didn't Reagan also work to weaken the provisions of the Voting Rights Act that made it enforceable? So now, Nicole, we're seeing contradictions even in what President Reagan said and what we see happening right now today in the 21st century.
Yeah. And I think, you know, again, kind of in the period that we are in right now as a country, especially in a period where we have witnessed an increase, for instance, in election denialism, that it has raised the stakes even more. And so that's why I think particularly among Democrats, there is still this desire to continue to push legislation like this. And I think we will see more of a greater emphasis towards the issue of voting rights, particularly on the state level, as we have seen over the past couple of years. But more specifically, I think given the difficult chances that legislation like this may face in Congress right now, I think you're going to see greater strides in state legislatures, both Republican and Democrat. But certainly where you have a lot of Democrats in power, whether that's states like Michigan or Minnesota, Pennsylvania, we already know that there has been talk of trying to push more aggressive measures to try to restore voting rights for many citizens.
And we need that. I mean, never certainly did I think I would live to see the day that we are regressing, but that is exactly what is happening, and it has been happening for quite some time. And the really profound backlash of the election of the first African-American president, that being President Barack Obama, you see that backlash happening all over the country. We saw the loss of over 1,000 seats on all levels of government happened in that 2010 midterm election cycle. And certainly, as you point out, where Republicans control legislatures, I mean, I served in the Ohio legislature, in the Ohio Senate, and certainly saw up close and personal the onslaught of eroding voting access in my very own state. And the state of Ohio right now is one of the worst in terms of turning back the hands of time. And just because people are able to surmount hurdles does not mean that the hurdle is not there. And that, to me, is a very important point to make as voting rights activists like myself and so many others continue to push to give that unfettered access to the ballot box for all people, no matter how they want to vote. And it continues to boggle my mind why we as a quote unquote civilized society are still having this kind of debate in the 21st century about that access. In 2014, you may recall, I ran for Secretary of State in the great state of Ohio. And part of my campaign foundation was I'm here to fight for your right to vote, even if you want to vote against me. And we need more people, especially secretaries of states, to uphold that this is really not about whether somebody leans right or left or whether they're on the so-called red or blue team. It is about each and every person in this country being able to exercise one of the greatest equalizers that we have in this society today. And that is one man, one woman, or one person, one vote.
And I think you make a good point with respect to your own race for Secretary of State. I mean, I think that was one of the more interesting things to watch, particularly in this midterm cycle, because most of the time people are paying attention to the congressional races. But these Secretary of State races were just as consequential, especially when you had many candidates in states like, you know, Arizona, Nevada, and others, where you had these candidates who were running on election denialism and wanting to control the process for voting at the state level. You know, many of those candidates ultimately did not succeed, but it did raise, I think, a lot of concern and attention to how the process is handled. So much so now we are also hearing about the need for greater reforms, for instance, for poll workers.
We'll be right back with Nicole Killian, congressional correspondent for CBS News. Welcome back to the Martin Luther King Jr. Day holiday special from CBS News. I'm Nina Turner. We return to our conversation about voting rights in the United States with Nicole Killian, congressional correspondent for CBS News. The remedies that Congress proposed, I mean, you mentioned the John Lewis Voting Rights Act as one of those. Are there other things that this Congress, in your mind, could be putting forward, whether or not they win bipartisan support, to try to push back on some extremists in state legislatures to secure voting rights access?
Well, I think you also saw the legislation, the Freedom to Vote Act, and that was kind of more practical in effect in terms of, for instance, trying to expand mail-in voting, early voting, automatic voter registration. Again, that too did not succeed in the last Congress, but it does kind of lay the groundwork. As you know, of course, politics is cyclical. So, you know, we don't know what will happen come 2024 in terms of whether the power dynamics change. But again, I think just because it may be a heavy lift in this Congress doesn't necessarily mean that the work won't be pursued and the work won't get done. And I think if anything, again, it's probably a scenario where you will see more of this type of action and work taking place on the state level, which is pretty much how it has been playing out and how it often plays out when there is gridlock or inaction in Congress. And again, you know, whether it's states like Michigan or Minnesota or again, Pennsylvania, which now have Democratic governors or Democratic governors continuing in positions of power, again, they have made clear that they will try to move forward on other priorities, whether that is creating automatic voter registration systems, similar to, you know, what's being proposed in Congress, or, for instance, pre-registering teenagers to vote before they turn 18, returning the franchise to felons who are released from prison, and criminalizing election misinformation. So I do think, depending on how things play out at the state level, we may see more reforms down the line. But again, to the contrary, you have a number of Republican legislatures as well, which may be trying to tighten the reins. You know, kind of getting back to my experience in Georgia, one thing that I thought was interesting and notable is that the Secretary of State there did acknowledge, even though he feels that the new law that they put in place, you know, prior to this election cycle, that it did not lead to greater voter suppression. But he did acknowledge it may need to be reformed. You know, there were a lot of people, again, who had their eligibility challenged to the point where a lot of these claims were frivolous. And even the Secretary of State acknowledged, hey, you know, we may need to look at that. So, you know, I think there are efforts, again, across many states to try to reevaluate even some of these stricter laws and policies as needed as the process plays out. So I think that's also something to watch going forward.
I agree with you. And certainly acknowledgement is a start, albeit light, but it is a start. Well, thank you so very much, Nicole, for being with us. We really appreciate you giving us the lay of the land as it is happening right now. Nicole Killian, congressional correspondent for CBS News. It was a pleasure to have you here with us today.
The Hargan women seemed to have it all.
We were blessed. My mom was amazing.
But detectives would soon discover...
Inside the house, there were the bodies of two women.
A story of betrayal you would struggle to believe if it wasn't true.
I am just praying to God. This is a sick joke.
From 48 Hours, this is Blood is Thicker, The Hargan Family Killings. Listen to Blood is Thicker, The Hargan Family Killings, early and ad-free on Wondery Plus, starting May 1st.